Welcome to a new edition of the Neon Jazz Interview Series with post-bop jazz pianist and a talent garnering a slew of worthy reviews these days, Mark Carey. On the heels of releasing his newest album, Roads Ahead, Volume 2, he is a busy cat these days keeping up with the demand of his quality music. From the streets of Washington, D.C., he was swayed well by the influence of his family, along with going to the Duke Ellington School for the Arts. He has called New York City home for quite some time and has played with some of the biggest names in jazz. Mark has plenty of wisdom, stories, and insight. Please dig it, my friends.
So I'm just going to dive right in here. I know you're a busy man, so I'm going to ask you, first of all, what has been going on lately?
Well, I tell you, it's been music all the time for me, music and family. You know, we've been pushing on this end to develop outside of the music, but for the music, develop the engine to keep things moving. You know, it's been a pretty long journey to find this combination of people. You know,
yeah.
So that's been a lot of the focus. Just the maintenance that goes into keeping the engine running.
Yeah,
you know, the music is really easy for me, man. That's the part that comes. You know, the creative part is probably about 10% of what we get to do, you know. And that happens once we get that little hour to really play for people. You know, everything else is preparation and practice and you know, tour schedules and you know, itineraries. You know, just making sure things are in place so when I go away, when I come back, that, you know, it's not mayhem, you know, things like that, man. But that's the biggest scope. But as far as musically, man, it's been one of the most active points in my career you know.
Yeah.
I've been very active all throughout the last 20 years while developing the different groups. I've been playing with a lot of different people, like, you know, as you know, Abby and Betty and Roy, and the list goes on. But to be this active supporting my own stuff is really a treat, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because the energy feels like it's reciprocating itself. It's going in to something that is benefiting me directly and my family, you know. So.
Yeah, that's great. I couldn't help but think when you were talking about getting the right cast around you, the ending credits of the movie, you're amazed at how many people go into a production. But there is a lot of people, you know.
Yeah, there really are. And you can't control what their output of productivity will actually be. I mean, you know, most people talk, you know, we're taught to sound as if we're professional at, you know, every level. You know, when we're getting paid, because you're considered professional when you're getting paid to some degree, you know.
Yeah,
But a lot of people do things that they can't, say they do things that they can't do. And then you look up and 8 months later and you realize, wow, this is not going to work.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And it takes that much time to find out sometimes.
Yeah, true. When you're
but this cycle is, this cycle has been educational as well as productive, you know, so. I'm really happy.
Well, the cool thing is that you hit on a key thing there in one of your first sentences. You said the journey, and it's been 16 years since volume one of Roads Ahead, and now we're at volume two. This has been kind of a breakout album. Why did it take so long to get to this point?
I tell you, man, I started in several points, which is something I never mentioned before, but when I'm looking back at the way things go, I think it has a lot to do with the order of things, you know. When you have a project going, such as I had, like Focus Trio. Once I focused on Focus Trio, we began to get some momentum, and it's not a good thing to stop in the middle to do something else, you know, once you get momentum. It's been a very gradual momentum too for the Focus Trio, but it's populated some regions that, you know, took that long to get to, really. You know, we've opened up some space for ourselves. But I think because I was so into the other group and developing that and the full arc, you know, of what we can do, you know, and opening up the different doors. That took a while, as well as when I first did, when I did Volume 1, I felt pretty lucky, you know, that I wasn't, you know, scorned at that time. You know, the environment was a lot different then, you know.
Yeah.
So I kind of like opened up a path that wasn't really supported, you know, by the engine that you need behind any kind of project. I didn't have that engine behind that project as much as we were a big success, you know.
Yeah.
So I think it's just due to not having the capable people. I hate to say the right people, but the capable people. Because a lot of times people come and they have good intentions, you know, but it becomes a good intention fallacy. You know, not to be negative, but, you know, when you ask what took so long, it's like I got to really take an account.
Oh, yeah.
All the effort that went into moving it forward.
Yeah.
You know? So, you know.
So speaking of moving things forward in your life, your bio is a rich tapestry of all kinds of cool things. And there's a lot of things in it that I've kind of picked out that I'm interested in about your life and who you are. And your mom seems like an enormously interesting individual as a cellist and with her background in the Indian Nation. How did that influence you in your music and your life overall?
It influenced me wholly. It's really the fabric by which I think I get my momentum, you know, my ability to appreciate my talent, you know. I come from a very strong family in my mind, you know. The people that I was exposed to, my grandparents and my great-grandparents and my mother being the one that kind of kept the legacy of storyteller and history, history teller. You know, the history keeper in the family. So my mom is a bit of a griot in that way. She was, you know, very aware of my ability early, and also the fact that I could probably do anything really well. It's just what could I focus on that would be positive?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I probably could have been a really great, you know, pimp or a really great thug or something as well. This is what, you know, just as much as I am a piano player. So yeah. It was a matter of focusing me. And I really thank my mom for that because, you know, at the time I grew up is when crack came out, and it was right after the heroin epidemic. And I grew up in D.C. between, you know, D.C. and is exposed to Baltimore and that time period was very dark as well as rich, dark and rich, you know? So that was the exposure, but I grew up in a very community oriented environment where my brother he is an acupuncturist. He's a practicing acupuncturist, and he would go into the community and treat addicts, drug addicts. So be in the project. Yeah, I'd be in the projects with him, giving, you know, health fairs that he would put on himself on the spot. You know, he would go and bring his pamphlets and gather people. And I was the one that was always like, oh, my God, what are we doing here? But then I realized how intention and just confidence can get you anywhere, you know, and a sense of ability to have empathy and compassion for people. That is the thing that translates, you know.
Yeah.
And I was around people that could do that in their various ways, you know. My mother's a great storyteller and a great community person, because her mother was, you know, and so was my grandmother's mother, you know, who I knew very well. When you ask people in Providence about them, their names come up, you know, for those that remember, as the kind of people that help people in the community, you know. So I had to figure out how I could help and not become something negative to my environment, you know, which is what you have to worry about with your children.
Yeah, true. Amen. Yeah.
Yeah, so you do. Yeah.
You got to protect them. Yeah, you got to lead them in the right way. So as a kid, speaking of, what did you want to do when you grew up?
Well, I tell you, you know, as a child, man, I grew up pretty early, pretty fast, you know, not to really go too deep into my parents, but I had very opposite spectrums as far as, well, I had a wide spectrum of examples in my family, shall I say.
Yeah.
Everything from, you know, spiritual advisors to street people, you know. So my choices came very pointed for me. My talent was my choice.
Yeah.
You know, because I saw other people who, my father, my stepfather, you know, bless him, man. He's a great man to take me on with two children, you know, himself. As a single father. My mother was a single mother, and he was a single father. He had two, and they married. So I had instant brother and sister.
Yeah.
At the age of 7, so that was like a big shock, because it was just me and my mom since I was 1, you know. Yeah. And my mother's a dancer, so I grew up around the drums, you know.
Yeah.
I grew up in the dance, you know, practice, rehearsal studios, and the theater student on the theater sets, on stage, behind stage. My mother worked as a theater crew and, you know, did everything in the repertory theaters in Providence and DC. So I believe that, you know, being exposed to that kind of gave me the drive to dig into my talent. I was just around talent, people that dealt with what they had, you know?
Yeah.
And weren't asking to be a part of, a company or a corporation. They were people that were, you know, self-reliant, you know, on what they had. And I felt that I could do that. But just to finish, Washington, D.C. at that time had Mayor Berry. Mayor Berry provided a lot of opportunities for kids like me. He provided a performance venue called Let 'Em Play, which was it was housed at Howard Theater, not Howard Theater, but Howard University in Crampton Auditorium. And there was a truck that had a stage that much like Jazzmobile or something like that. It went around all the communities, you know, northeast, northwest, southeast, southwest, and all the communities within those squadrons. And we'd perform. So I learned how to perform very early and learn standards. I mean, I had great teachers, you know. And from there, as a young person, the hippest thing to be was a musician, either that or in the sports.
Yeah.
Other than that, you had, you know, you could be a thug or you could be a scholar, you know. I mean, you could be a lot of things, but those that had opportunities were, you know, things were still changing when I was growing up. So
absolutely. You know, well, That's a good point. I was going to get to the Duke Ellington School of the Arts. How influential was that on you?
Extremely. It was the most influential time of my life because it was like an ability, a time where I could actually focus totally on art and developing all the parts, being a part of all the different disciplines, you know. From theater to creative writing to dance to music, you know. And being a musician, you were put into all of those environments some way or another, whether it was creative writing to learn how to write songs or to deal with poetry, or whether it was being the music behind the dance, you know, or the theater, you know what I mean? So,
yeah.
I was exposed to all the different disciplines there, and also exposed to all the cats that were doing stuff. Like, I met Wynton Marsalis when I was in the 10th grade.
Wow.
And from there, I retained a close relationship with him. You know, I was able to, you know, talked to him at different periods of my career, I mean, he's the person that embarrassed me the most on the stage, you know, in front of my whole school. Like, those kind of lessons were invaluable, man. Yeah. He called me up. Everybody was like, yeah, Mark's the shit, you know. When he came to school, you school up and play. And so went and called me up, you know, and invited me up to play a blues. And right to two bars in, he stopped the whole band in front of the whole school.
Wow.
And came over to me and over my back showed me some chords that he wanted me to play.
Yeah.
You know? So that was like a humiliating opportunity to learn how to be on stage and how to not run off stage crying in embarrassment and not how to put your humility, you know, how to use humility and put your ego in your pocket.
Yeah.
Because as far as I knew, I was pretty good. I was pretty dope at that point, you know?
Yeah.
And I'd never been embarrassed like that. And then I went on to have a whole career of embarrassment.
Oh, man, it's those early years of those lessons, man. They're important, that's for sure.
They really are, man. They give you character, man. They show you the way because, first of all, you wouldn't be embarrassed if people didn't care. People just let you sound like shit, man, and just would look at you then be making faces, you know what I mean? While you got your back to you, your head down playing, thinking you're grooving, everybody else is making faces at you. So, you know.
Well, it's Wynton Marsalis. It's not like it's some dude that you're not sure if he's really into being a teacher or not. This is like a master reach of children.
That's my point. I was exposed to cats that you could trust that came to our school because they cared to show, you know, to see who was there and what you were doing. And if you were showing potential to kind of give you something to help you humble yourself and move forward, you know.
Yeah.
Like that was one of the most humbling moments that actually – gave me the ball to move on.
Yeah.
Because,
absolutely.
And to jump in the fire. I'd already been pushed in the fire. So I knew what the fire felt like.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, absolutely. So you started out on the drums, moved on to trumpet, and landed on the keys. Why are the keys the thing that really is the one that you want to be on?
Opportunity, man. I was in a band. I did all that stuff within my group, my own group, you know. Like I said, the best thing you could do is be in a band. So go-go bands were the opportunities for young people back then, like hip-hop would be now. And it still is. I mean, still, if you go to D.C., it's like going into another world because, you know, you pull up next to a car with his windows down in New York, you're going to hear hip-hop or R&B or maybe some Dominican, you know, some merengue or something like that, depending on what part of town you're in. Never will you hear go-go or anything that's indigenous to that place. See what I'm saying? Hip-hop would be the most indigenous thing, but, you know, it's not even really what it started off to be anyway. It's a new form now. It's new stuff. It's in industry music.
Yeah,
but
absolutely.
In D.C., you got indigenous music. So to be a part of something that is unique, you know, that actually needs to be studied in order to be mastered and can't be just triggered, you know, was an enormous... First of all, it was profound, and I knew the value of it when I was growing up.
Yeah.
You know, I knew the difference between hitting a button on an MPC and sampling somebody's stuff, as opposed to actually learning what that was that they played and then replaying it live, you know, with musicians and using musicianship, you know, or creating from a rhythm that's born in a place that you're from, you know. So, like, that kind of thing gave me, like, confidence. It gave me a sense of identity, you know. I mean, when I was 14, we were winning the Battle of the Bands, you know. I wasn't on drums, though, which was really, I wanted to be a drummer. If you ask anybody at home, I'm a drummer.
Yeah.
I got drums set up right here. I keep my drums set up, man. I got my conga set up, my drums. Because I started off in the percussion lab when I got to Duke Ellington.
Yeah.
Piano was my minor, percussion was my major. And then I flipped that and went to piano because at that time I found this cat named Ricky, who was just really killing, man. I mean, he had a foot that was ridiculous, you know.
Yeah.
And so I was like, man, I had a keyboard. I had a Wurlitzer in my house. So I was like, I play Wurlitzer, you know.
Yeah.
And I've been tapping on the keys ever since I was a kid, so. It's just a matter of choosing.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, the one thing I did read, too, about you was that you said the span of 16 to 21 was the most growth in your life. And now that you're a man over your mid-40s, do you still believe that, or do you believe there's been another period of growth that's been more profound?
Well, what I meant by that is the growth that I had at that point, I equated to pretty much a life's experience, a life's worth of experience. And it was not, had nothing to do with music, you know. I've grown based on those principles that I learned then. I believe that everyone goes through a period in their life where they have a low, you know. I had my low point for me then. Everything has been a steady climb, you know, as far as building my inner character, you know, which has a lot to do with my outer, you know, how I deal with the interface with people, how I deal with people. Like, I had a family when I was very early, so that was probably the next most profound point of development, you know.
Absolutely.
Music is something that I love, man, and I will do anything to develop that. So I don't really look at that as, I think that's one of my attributes, you know, but the thing that makes me, the thing that defines me, I think, is my ability to take care of my responsibilities, you know.
Absolutely.
The children that I brought here, and now my grandson, that's my biggest responsibility. Yeah. Playing music and showing up on time, I mean, that's my responsibility as an employee to someone. But learning and becoming the best Mark Carey that I could be is just, that's just something that's an inner task. That's something that I choose to be. You know, I really want to be the best. And Coltrane gave me that idea. He said, I want to be the best John Coltrane that I can be. Not the best saxophone player, but the best John Coltrane. I was like, now that's shit.
Yeah.
That defines you. That's like, yeah, if you could be the best you. Those are the kind of things when I meant growth. And that enabled me to interface with people like Abby Lincoln and Betty Carter, man, who tested me on another level, you know.
Good you mentioned that, because I could tell from really delving into your story is that those two played a profound role in your life, and I'm curious as to how did they move you as a musician and a human being?
Well, I would say this, to preface that, I speak of them the most, but they didn't make the most impact. They made an incredible impact because of the opportunity, for one, that they gave me to develop on the spot, on demand, actually, and to fit into the shoes that were already on that stage, you know, or able to put my shoes next to them, you know, so nobody missed nothing. So I was challenged to step up to the plate, like, immediately with these women. And the thing about the women is that they treat you different than the guys do, you know. And this is what Betty always said. She said, listen, you're not going to be in my band forever. She had a school. So you graduate or you get put out of that school. That's how it works. And what she told me was at the end of my time with her, which was an extended time, it was like 2.5 years, you know. At the end of my time period with her, she said, listen, it's time for you to go play with the guys. And she put an envelope in my vest pocket, you know, of my jacket. And I looked at it, and with my severance pay. And she smiled at me. She said, it's time for you to go play with the guys. And she had always said, yeah, y'all, I ain't going to know what, you'll know what I'm talking about after you leave my band. It's a certain etiquette that the women have. And some of the guys have that, you know, but predominantly the guys don't have it. They're not going to tell you that you don't sound like, that you sound like shit and why. And they're not going to tell you to make love to the melody. They're going to say that you sound like shit, man, you know, get off my stage, you know. It's a different kind of mentality. If you squeak one more time, you're fired. You know, I've heard that line said to a musician. By one of the guys. So she basically, you know, and then the money, you get, everything's done differently. I don't want to say the guys don't give you money, but women treat you different, man. That's all I can say.
Yeah. Yeah.
And they've been the ones that have hired and employed and gave guys the opportunity to take care of their families, you know. So when I speak of them, I speak of them highly because they gave me the opportunity to raise my family, you know.
Yeah.
They paid my way.
Absolutely.
I mean, I worked hard, but they paid me well for the time that I was away from my family so that I could take care of, you know, make sure that things were done, man. Rent was paid. Private school was paid for the time period my kids were in private school, you know.
Yeah.
Things like that, man, were important.
See, you played with a lot of heavy hitters in the jazz realm. Who would you consider your jazz heroes?
Well, I'm going to tell you like this. Anyone that considers themselves a jazz musician has an impact on the music itself. They're a contributor. They're the reason why the music is still intact. So my heroes are those that call themselves, you know, the keepers of the music. It don't have to be jazz. It's the music of our people, as Duke said. That this at large. And then there are people that directly affected me who have another impact on me, a direct impact. But really, musicians are incredible people, man. All musicians of all styles. Because the art of you know, becoming one with your instrument and being able to express yourself is what inspires me, you know. The dedication that it takes to be a musician, to be anything, but we're specifically talking about musicians and, you know, and artists. But to me, a statement that Abby said was so profound, and she said, the difference between us and the other animals is that we practice the art. She said the difference between human beings and the other animals is that human beings practice the arts. And if you don't practice the arts, then you're not a human being.
Yeah.
So, you know, that statement, although it's a very, you know, I mean, it's her statement. It has a lot of weight to me, you know.
Yeah.
And I think that the arts give you a certain sensibility that you don't get from anything else.
Absolutely.
And science is another thing, you know, the math is another thing, but the art of those things, you know, the thing that makes that art, to me, the part that gives you compassion, it gives you the ability to feel, you know.
Speaking of the compassion and the feeling, what's the greatest thing about waking up every day for you?
Taking that breath, man, and having consciousness. What I think is consciousness. The other day I had a dream I was awake, though, and that freaked me out, man, because I was like, wow.
Yeah.
So maybe I'm, you know what I mean? So
yeah.
I'm still trying to interpret that. But so I, from what I can tell, the first thing is the consciousness, the ability to love the people that I love and maybe possibly love some new people. That opportunity is the thing.
Yeah.
And also, you know, I'm the human part of me has hope that when I wake up, something might change, you know.
Yeah.
And the change also has, you know, the change has to come from everybody, but there's no way of telling whether somebody's doing anything to make change, you know.
Yeah.
So you can only hope, you know, like I hope that you did something to make change for the world today and that I have impacted somebody. You know what I mean? And that, like, collectively, if we all did our part, you know, so, like, I mean, I'm not trying to be on no extra spiritual stuff, man, but that's actually the first thing that really hits me when I wake up, you know. And then you put that into a practical sense, like, see, I got family, man. I wake up, I get my children again, you know, and teach them something that might help them or learn something that might help me.
Absolutely. Absolutely, man.
Yeah.
Let me put a scenario out. Let's say the next show you leave, there's a time machine waiting out in front for you instead of your bus. and you can climb in and put in the digits to any show in history, any music show in history, where would you go? What would you watch?
Wow. Man, there's a few. Well, how long is it? Just like a one-shot deal? You go one spot, or
you can bounce around. You can have a night of it.
Yeah, if I can make a night of it, man, I'd go to see Earl Garner, do his thing, the concert by the sea. I go over there to the Bay, and then I go see Ahmad do his thing, Poinciana. I probably hit the Blackhawk and check out Miles live at the Blackhawk. I really want to see Duke at Newport, you know, playing some of that that Far East suite. That would be dope. Let me see if I can make it to Antibes and see Coltrane doing Love Supreme.
Man. That'd be mind-blowing. Oh, my God.
If I could make that and then possibly make the first night of Chick Corea and Herbie Hancock's duo, the first concert that they did before they codified it on that tour, I want to see when they were trying to figure each other out. I want to see that night.
Yeah.
Well, there's a couple more, man, but maybe if I could see Buffy St. Marie at Wolf Trap and Jimi Hendrix,
man,
that might round it off, you know.
That'd be a hell of a trip, man.
Yeah.
That's for sure. Yeah. That would be a cool trip. So
one more, though. I would love
back. Yeah.
I would love to go back to that night at the Bottom Line with Betty Carter. Just so I could hug my grandfather one more time, man.
Yeah.
Funny thing about that CD is so beautiful. It's one of my favorites because I can hear him laughing on there.
Man.
And I can hear him shout my name. And that was one of the last time I saw him in his full spirit, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, that would be the last one. Yeah, man.
That's very cool. So you know, your career's on an upswing. Everything's firing away. What's next for you? The proverbial next for you. What do you want to do?
Well, you know, it's a lot I've been doing that people haven't even heard. So I just would like to share some of what's happening with people, what I've been doing. I mean, a lot of people are kind of catching this curve, which is great, man. I feel like I've been waiting for a while for my turn, you know, and I'm patient, man. I just keep my tools sharp, man. Just make sure that, you know, when I'm called, I'm ready to hit that ball. You know, you don't want to get out there and don't hit the ball, man. I mean, so, you know, for me, it's just staying sharp, man. I'm ready to go play for the people, man. My grandmother told me, she said, Mark, play pretty for the people. That's the last thing she would tell me when I would talk to her before a gig or something like that, you know, or before I went on tour with Betty. She would say, play pretty for the people. So I just like the opportunities, you know, that are left to share, you know.
Yeah.
And I really, what I want to do is to be able to help the gentlemen that play for me take care of their families, you know,
cool.
Because everybody's been real patient all over these years, man. And everything's been a little bit here and there, and the consistency has been in the fact that they're still here, you know, and that they're enthusiastic about the journey and about what's happening. And if people haven't gotten better and like, oh, shit, I'm tired, man, and, you know, just when the shit starts, because that's normally how things happen. Just when everything starts to line up, other stuff starts to fall apart. So maintaining all the pieces, you know, has been one of the main things. It's just like I'm a busy bee over here maintaining, you know?
Yeah, absolutely.
It gets weathered, man. So I'm cool. My spirits are good, man. I have no pride. I know what I want to do. I chose this. It chose me. So I'm in line with it. It's just keeping everybody in line with the vision, you know.
Harmony. Yeah, harmony. Man, this is the perfect spot to end it. I think you hit everything on the head. It was refreshing to talk with you, man. Continued success. I love talking to you guys and getting into kind of just how it goes, and I love you guys. The language you give us soothes us, man, and I appreciate it.
Oh, man, I appreciate it, man. Well, I tell you what, you know, you can only really judge your success by the way other people see you. I mean, I feel successful within myself. I've always felt that way, but this is a new success, man. It's because it's being noticed by people like yourself, man. So I thank you for noticing, man. Thank you.
Right on. Yeah, thank you.
All right,
man.
Bro.
Thanks for listening and tuning in to yet another Neon Jazz interview, where we give you a bit of insight into the finest players in New York City, Kansas City, and spots all over America, giving fans all that jazz. And thanks to Mark Carey for his music and being a force in the world of jazz these days. If you want to hear more interviews, go to Famous Interviews with Joe Dimino on the iTunes Store, or you can always visit theneonjazz.blogspot.com for all things Neon Jazz. Until next time, enjoy the music, my friends.
Neon Jazz.